You are listening to Coffee Before Pants. Hello and welcome to another episode of Coffee Before Pants, the podcast for readers, writers, poets, rebels, and wallflowers. This, believe it or not, is episode number 16. I am Mark, as usual. I plan on being that way for at least the duration of this episode, probably longer. Well, it's finally March, and that can mean only one thing. No, I'm not talking about college basketball. I'm talking about St. Patrick's Day. It's the time of the year where everyone wears green and drinks far too much than they should and thinks they're Irish when they're really not. However, I'm going to take this opportunity to celebrate the Irish literary history for the whole of March. There are too many writers, poets, and playwrights that came from Ireland to be covered in just one episode. For this episode, I want to focus on the writers of novels and short stories, although some of the writers can't be pigeonholed into that. Next time, it will be the poets and then the playwrights. For the fourth week, well, I haven't thought that far ahead yet. I'm sure I can come up with something. And just as a side note, we are all familiar with who St. Patrick was and what he represents, right? This kind of falls under the lies my teacher told me category. The truth is not nearly as storybook-like as it seems. Legend has it that Patrick stood on an Irish hillside and delivered a sermon that drove the island's serpents into the sea. While it's true that the Emerald Isle is mercifully snake-free, chances are that that's been the case throughout human history. Water has surrounded Ireland since the end of the last glacial period, preventing snakes from slithering over, and before that, it was blanketed in ice and too chilly for the cold-blooded creatures. Scholars believe the snake story is an allegory for St. Patrick's eradication of the pagan ideology. That's right, St. Patrick eradicated the pagan religions. Just like the Christians before him and after him, he forced his religion on others. Others that were there long before he or his religion was. There is a chance that he wasn't even Irish, but a Roman sent from the Vatican to convert people. Most likely in a violent fashion. Believe in my God or else, or something like that. But before I get too riled up about that, and before we talk about the writers of Ireland, let's talk about Coffee with Culture, a review of the history of this week. And by the way, if you like what you hear on this or previous podcast episodes, slide the like button closer to you and whisper, "I would gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today." You can subscribe to the podcast on your preferred podcast platform. Also, there is a Coffee Before Pants Facebook page. I'll put a link on the summary. And now, Coffee with Culture, this week in history of literature, music, theater, and film. March 3rd, 1887, Anne Sullivan began working in the Keller household for their six-year-old daughter, who was deaf and blind. Although Sullivan did not get along with the parents, she and their daughter Helen got along better, and Sullivan soon found a way to teach Helen both reading and writing. The two became an iconic duo, gaining national attention as Keller's accomplishments grew. The story was later featured in the play The Miracle Worker. March 3, 1911, actress Jean Harlow was born on this day. She was an American actress known for her portrayal of bad girl characters and was the leading sex symbol of the early 1930s. She was one of the defining figures of the pre-code era of American cinema. Harlow died at the young age of 26 from kidney failure, stemming from a bout of scarlet fever when she was 15. Bear in mind, dialysis and kidney transplant had not come to fruition at the time of her illness. March 3rd, 1959, today is the birthday of Ira Glass, host of the weekly public radio program and podcast, This American Life. March 4th, 1678, Italian composer and violinist Antonio Vivaldi, who left a decisive mark on the form of the concerto and the style of late Baroque instrumental music, was born. March 4th, 1922, the first vampire film, Nosferatu, an unauthorized adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula, premieres at the Berlin Zoological Garden in Germany. Bram Stoker's widow, Florence, sued the director, F.W. Murnau, for copyright infringement and won. The judge in the case ordered all prints of the film destroyed, and we all know that didn't happen, thankfully. March 4th, 1963, imagist poet William Carlos Williams died in his sleep at his home in Rutherford, New Jersey. Besides being a poet, Williams was a practicing physician, serving as the chief of pediatrics until his death. One of the reasons that his poems were short was that he wrote many of them on the pocket notepads doctors would carry. March 4, 2009, American playwright and screenwriter Horton Foote, who evoked American life in beautifully observed minimal stories and was perhaps best known for his adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird, died in Connecticut at the age of 92. March 5, 1750, Shakespeare's Richard III was performed in Williamsburg, Virginia. This marks the first time one of Shakespeare's plays was performed in America. The Virginia Shakespeare Festival still takes place each year in Williamsburg to this day. March 5, 1853, marks the birthday of Howard Pyle, American illustrator, painter, and author, best known for the children's books that he wrote and illustrated. Many of Pyle's children's stories, illustrated by the author with vividness and historical accuracy, have become classics. Most notably, The Merry Adventures of Robin Hood, Otto of the Silver Hand, Jack Ballister's Fortunes, and his own folktales, Pepper and Salt, The Wonder Clock, and The Garden Behind the Moon. March 5, 1982, John Belushi died from combined drug intoxication at the age of 33 after a drug dealer, Kathy Smith, injected him with a mixture of heroin and cocaine known as a speedball at the Chateau Marmont. He was posthumously honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 2004. March 6, 1806, Victorian poet Elizabeth Barrett Browning was born in Durham, England. Barrett Browning was a prolific poet, writing poems since the age of six. She is also remembered for her marriage to the famous poet Robert Browning and their strong love, lasting until Barrett Browning's death in 1861. March 6, 1927, Latin American author Gabriel Garcia Marquez was born in Aracataca, Colombia. He is known for several novels, including 100 Years of Solitude, Love in the Time of Cholera, and No One Writes to the Colonel. Garcia Marquez experimented more with less traditional approaches to reality, also known as magical realism. I kind of touched on that a few episodes back. So that, to quote George R. Murphy in his critical essays, the most frightful and the most unusual things are told with a deadpan expression. A commonly cited example is the physical and spiritual ascending into heaven of a character while she is hanging the laundry out to dry, and that's from 100 Years of Solitude. March 6, 1973 marks the release of Closing Time, the debut of singer-songwriter and all-around musical genius Tom Waits. 51 years later, and he's still going strong. March 7, 1924, modernist playwright and author Kobo Abe was born in Tokyo. Abe was once a prominent figure of the Communist Party, but publicly renounced their views in 1967. He died in 1993 and is remembered for his contributions to realist and absurdist fiction. He is known for his novels The Boxman, The Face of Another, one of my favorite books, and The Woman in the Dunes. March 7, 1963, John Coltrane and Johnny Hartman recorded their self-titled album at Van Gelder Studio in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. March 7, 1999, Stanley Kubrick, director of 2001 A Space Odyssey, Barry Lyndon, and Dr. Strangelove, died on this day. March 8, 1978, the first episode of Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy aired on BBC Radio. The series became increasingly popular and won several awards. The episodes were later compiled in a novel form, resulting in Douglas Adams' popular novels by the same name. March 9, 1892, British author and poet Vida Sackville-West, later known as Lady Nicholson, was born in Kent. Sackville-West wrote numerous poem collections and 13 novels, but she is best remembered as a close friend and later lover of Virginia Woolf. Sackville-West helped Woolf overcome her crippling anxiety and self-doubt, producing better writing in both women. Virginia Woolf based the androgynous protagonist of her novel Orlando on Vida Sackville-West. Just as an aside, if you ever get a chance to watch the movie Orlando, directed by Sally Potter, it stars Tilda Swinton. She's amazing, as always. It's a wonderful movie, total magical realism, and I recommend it. It's one of my top 50 movies. Top 50 movies that I have ever seen. And last but not least, March 9th, 1930, American jazz saxophonist, composer, and bandleader Ornette Coleman was born in Fort Worth, Texas. Now onto the writers, poets, and playwrights of Ireland. According to Britannica.com, after the Greek and Latin literature, literature in Irish is the oldest literature in Europe, dating from the 4th or 5th century Common Era. The presence of a dual tradition in Irish writing has been important in shaping and inflecting the material written in English, the language of Ireland's colonizers. Irish writing is, despite its unique national and linguistic characteristics, inevitably intertwined with English literature, and this relationship has led frequently to the absorption of Irish writers and texts into the canon of English literature. Many of the best-known Irish authors lived and worked for long periods in exile, often in England, and this too has contributed to a sense of instability in the development of a canon defined as uniquely Irish. In researching this, despite my best intentions, I realized that one can't pigeonhole any of the writers into the writer, poet, dramatist. Most of the writers to be discussed here are known for more than just one literary form. For example, our first writer I'm featuring here is none other than Oscar Wilde. After writing in different forms throughout the 1880s, he became one of the most popular playwrights in London in the early 1890s. He's best known for his epigrams and plays, his novel The Picture of Dorian Gray, and his criminal conviction for gross indecency for homosexual acts. Oscar Wilde is mostly known for being a playwright, but he also wrote poetry, such as The Ballad of Reading Gaol, which was about his time in prison, short fiction, one novel, as I said, The Picture of Dorian Gray. Though Wilde wrote 9 plays in all between 1879 and 1894, his fame as a dramatist rests entirely on 4 comedies: Lady Windermere's Fan, in 1893, A Woman of No Importance, also in 1893, An Ideal Husband, 1899, and one I'm sure most of you have heard of, The Importance of Being Earnest, 1895. He wrote only one novel, as I've said twice before. He wrote only one novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, yet he wrote 14 celebrated short stories in his eventful yet brief career. Oscar Wilde was born on October 16, 1854, and died penniless on November 30, 1900. He was only 46 years old. There is a story, and it's a lot of the stories about famous last words are not true. That might be a subject for an episode later. Supposedly, his final words was he came out of a coma, looked around, and said, "This wallpaper is killing me. One of us has got to go," and then died. I doubt that really happened. Everybody likes a good ending story, though. Next author is George Bernard Shaw, known at his insistence as Bernard Shaw. He was an Irish playwright, critic, polemicist, and political activist. His influence on Western theater, culture, and politics extended from the 1880s to his death and beyond. He wrote more than 60 plays, including major works such as Man and Superman, Pygmalion, which was the basis of My Fair Lady, the musical, and St. Joan, with Range incorporating both contemporary satire and historical allegory. Shaw became the leading dramatist of his generation, and in 1925 was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. Born in Dublin, Shaw moved to London in 1876, where he struggled to establish himself as a writer and novelist, and embarked on a rigorous process of self-education. By the mid-1880s, he had become a respected theater and music critic. Following a political awakening, he joined the Gradualist Fabian Society and became its most prominent pamphleteer. Shaw had been writing plays for years before his first public success, Arms and the Man, in 1894. Influenced by Henrik Ibsen, he sought to introduce a new realism into English language drama, using his plays as vehicles to disseminate his political, social, and religious ideas. By the early 20th century, his reputation as a dramatist was secured with a series of critical and popular successes that included Major Barbara, The Doctor's Dilemma, and Caesar and Cleopatra. Shaw's expressed views were often very contentious. He promoted eugenics and alphabet reform and opposed vaccination and organized religion. He courted unpopularity by denouncing both sides of the First World War as equally culpable, and although not a Republican, castigated British policy on Ireland in the post-war period. These stances had no lasting effect on his standing or productivity as a dramatist. The interwar years saw a series of often ambitious plays, which achieved varying degrees of popular success. In 1938, he provided the screenplay for a film version of Pygmalion, for which he received an Academy Award. His appetite for politics and controversy remained undiminished. In the late 20s, he had largely renounced Fabian Society gradualism and often wrote and spoke favorably of dictatorships in the right and left. He expressed admiration for both Mussolini and Stalin. In the final decade of his life, he made fewer public statements, but continued to write prolifically until shortly before his death, age 94, having refused all state honors, including the Order of Merit in 1946. George Bernard Shaw was also born in 1854, like his contemporary Oscar Wilde, and was writing almost to the end of his life. He died in Herefordshire, England, in 1950 at the age of 96. Our next author is Jonathan Swift. He was an Anglo-Irish satirist, author, essayist, political pamphleteer, first for the Whigs, then for the Tories, poet, and Anglican cleric who became Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral, Dublin. Hence his common sobriquet, Dean Swift. Swift is remembered for works such as An Argument Against Abolishing Christianity, Gulliver's Travels, which is probably his most famous work to most people, and A Modest Proposal. He is regarded by Encyclopedia Britannica as the foremost prose satirist in the English language. He originally published all of his works under pseudonyms such as Lemuel Gulliver, Isaac Bickerstaff, or M.B. Drapier, or anonymously. He was a master of two styles of satire, the Horatian and the Juvenalian styles. His deadpan, ironic writing style, particularly in A Modest Proposal, has led to such satire being subsequently termed Swiftian. Swift's family had several interesting literary connections. His grandmother, Elizabeth Dryden Swift, was the niece of Erasmus Dryden, grandfather of poet John Dryden. The same grandmother's aunt, Catherine Throckmorton Dryden, was a first cousin of Elizabeth, wife of Sir Walter Raleigh. His great-great-grandmother, Margaret Godwin Swift, was the sister of Francis Godwin, author of Man and the Moon, which influenced parts of Swift's Gulliver's Travels. His uncle Thomas Swift married a daughter of poet and playwright Sir William Davenant, a godson of William Shakespeare. That's quite a pedigree. Most people know the basic story of Gulliver's Travel, probably through movies, namely the animated feature by the astounding Max Fleischer. However, as is usual, there's a lot more to the story than what the movie shows. It is a satirical view of the state of European government, and what Swift felt were petty differences between religions. It was an inquiry into whether people are inherently corrupt, or whether they become corrupt as time goes by. It's also a re-examination of the older ancients versus moderns controversy that Swift previously addressed in his Battle of the Books. That's pretty deep for what is basically known as a kid's book. A young adult book, maybe. And have you ever read A Modest Proposal? In my opinion, this was Swift at his satirical best. Published in 1729, that suggests living conditions in Ireland could be improved by butchering the children of the poor citizens of Ireland and selling them as food to wealthy English landlords. Now, Swift wasn't really suggesting people offer the better of their children as food. The purpose of the satire was to ridicule the politicians, elites, and landowners who did not see the poor Irish as a problem of human misery and suffering, but rather as an inconvenience. On my second attempt to attending university, this was a long time ago, I retook English 101 because it had been a few years. I'm pretty sure at the age of 26, I was older than the teaching assistant. I was definitely older than the freshman students. There was one student who was absolutely horrified that Swift suggested eating children. It was clear she had yet to develop a sense of irony and satire. Jonathan Swift died on October 19, 1745, in Dublin at the age of 77 after a possible stroke and eventual dementia. Next and lastly for this episode is Irish author Mary Lavin. She was actually born in Massachusetts to Irish parents and moved to Ireland at the age of 10. Her stories can be alarmingly dark, but with such subtlety that you might just miss it. She is often noted for exploring relationships between mothers and daughters and pays great attention to the complexity of these interpersonal relationships and domestic life. Lavin raised three daughters, primarily as a single mother in Ireland in the 50s and 60s, that's 1950s and 60s, and continued to write and maintain her family farm. She received later an honorary doctorate from the University College of Dublin. Mary Lavin is the author of Happiness and Other Stories, Tales from the Bective Bridge, and In the Middle of the Fields. The website IrishCentral.com included Lavin in a list of 8 Irish women writers who match up with Joyce and Yeats. I confess I've never heard of Mary Lavin before now, but I will be adding her to my to-be-read list. That is about it for this episode of Coffee Before Pants. Next week, and for the rest of the month of March, I will be featuring more Irish writers, poets, and playwrights. Before we call it a night, it is time for the Poem of the Week. When Charon Sleeps by John Sokol. It's a slow day in Hades when the boatman sleeps, like now as he leans against his push-pole, stuck in the black mud on this toll shore of the Acheron. Here, that river of woe laves his feet while loyal Cerberus sleeps at his side, with three eyes open, always sniffing the fetid air, for the smell of death and business, always dreaming of bonus bones. The farrier never sleeps for long, but for now he dozes. Meanwhile, we are dying. So you be Eurydice, and I'll be Orpheus. When the darkness takes you, I'll bring you back. I'll play my shibboleth song, bring coins for Charon, fresh meat for Cerberus. And when we reach the shore again, we'll drown the boatman. We'll sink his boat, we'll kill his dog, we'll never look back. John Sokol is an artist and poet who currently lives in Akron, Ohio. Charon's Sleep is from his poetry collection titled In the Summer of Cancer, published in 2001 by Endymion Press. Permission to read this poem was graciously given by the author. That is it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard, and I hope you come back next week for the continuation. And of course, I hope you find a few good books to read.
Well, in the merry month of May, now from me home I started, left the girls and two were nearly broken hearted, saluted father dear, kissed me darling mother, drank a pint of beer, me grief and tears to smother, then off to reap the corn and leaf where I was born. Got a stout brick for the banished ghost and goblets, a brand new pair of brogues to rot the love of the bogs and frighten all the dogs on the rocky road. To double a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, hunt a hare and turn her down the rocky road, and all the ways to double a mack for all the dogs. In Mullingar that night I rested them so weary, started by daylight, next morning light, and there he took a drop of the pure to keep me heart and drink, and that's the paddy's cure.
You have been listening to Coffee Before Pants, a Irish Banshee production.